I would rather be attacked by a bear than nibbled to death by ducks. Big stuff seems to be, and it deals with temperament. Some people can handle the big blow a lot better than they can handle a bunch of little stuff. And especially in regard to maintaining a Christian testimony, leaning on the Lord and having a spirit-filled life, it seems to be, in my case, looking at my own life and also observing others, that we seem to be able to handle the big blow and then we're knocked askew by something trivial. And that's what we've got with David here. David is fleeing for his life. Up till this point, he has, other than his brief run off to Gath, which I think he realized I'm in trouble after he got there. Other than that brief thing, he has handled this whole situation very well. He has done amazingly well. When you look at the hardship, the difficulty, he's got all these ne'er-do-wells that have gravitated to him. He has taken this group of ruffians, if you will, and consolidated them into a good fighting unit that are willing to take orders and willingness here. He is able to provide sustenance for the 600 men, and many of them have families with them. Just amazing. And then the opportunity, he refused to kill Saul. When that opportunity was handed to him on a golden platter, he would not do it. He would not do it. And he let Saul know that, and he proved it. He delivered Keilah, and he has done everything just right. And now we come to something trivial, and this is gonna put him in a very bad light. David has vanquished great enemies, and he's gonna come close, almost vanquished by a very small one. And understand that the biggest enemy we face is not the obnoxious coworker, not the family member that mocks your faith. The biggest enemy you've got is the one inside of you. You are the biggest enemy you face, as far as day-to-day goings on. So it has one verse there at the beginning of the chapter mentioned just in passing that Samuel died. And all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So he keeps moving. He was in En Gedi, overlooking the Dead Sea, way over on the east side of the wilderness of Judah. And now he's moving a little bit more central. He's going to be in the area not too far from Hebron, a little bit south of Hebron. So he's constantly on the move. He can't stay in any one place real long because Saul will find out where he is and trap him there. So it mentions in passing, we're introduced to another character. It says in verse 2, there was a man in Maon, a small town down in that region. We're dealing with an area that is mostly desert, but it does have rolling hills. They get a little bit of rain in the springtime, in late winter. And so there's enough grass to grow crops. In some of the valleys, you could probably still grow wheat and barley and that sort of thing. But it is much drier than further north, even around Jerusalem. And so you've got this man in Maon, and his possessions, it says, were in Carmel, or Carmel. There are two Carmels in the Bible. There's the one where Elijah had his showdown, and that's way up in the northwest overlooking the Mediterranean. It's a ridge there up in the north, beautiful area, lots of trees and stuff. Even today, Mount Carmel is covered with pine trees and oaks and cypress. But this Carmel is again, a small village near Maon. So he lives in Maon, and the next town over is Carmel, and that's where his business interests are. And it says the man was very great. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, back then, wealth was not just in silver and gold. Silver and gold might be pretty to look at, and it just sits there. But you can actually use your stock. And people did trading and stuff principally. It was not a cash society. Matter of fact, coins weren't going to be invented for another somewhere in the neighborhood of 500-600 years before coins were invented. You just had little chunks and pieces of gold and silver that they weighed out. So this man's wealth, like Job, starts out very similarly. He was very great. He had 3,000 sheep. He had 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, sheep shearing, even today in some places, rural districts of Australia, New Zealand, and parts of England, it is a sort of a festive occasion. And some of these towns in Australia, New Zealand, parts of Britain, they actually have festivals and so on that are in conjunction with this. And that has always been the case, going back to ancient times. And so you've got this guy, and his name, it says in verse 3, was Nabal. And the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding, a prudent and wise woman, a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. He has great ancestry. He comes from good stock. You know, Joshua and Caleb, he's a descendant of Caleb. He comes from good stock, but it says he is churlish and evil in his doings. He was a cheat. He was a scoundrel. And he ruled by temper. Some people... You're afraid they're going to blow up if you say something, so you tread lightly in their presence. You don't want to set them off, especially if there's somebody in positions of power or authority, and that's what you've got here. And this guy rules by fear, and he's an obnoxious so-and-so. He's got a great, you know, wife that is not only beautiful, but she's sharp. She's understanding. She is wise in her dealings. And opposites attract. So you've got this beautiful, wise, intelligent woman that understands and understands how people work, and then she's got this husband that somehow is phenomenal in his business dealings, but he just blunders through things and runs roughshod over people. And it says in verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. Now again, David's got a lot of people with him. How am I going to feed these people? Well, it's sheep shearing time up here. Maybe I can send a few of my men up there, and maybe they can, you know, bring home maybe a wagon load of goodies to help feed my people here. And so David sent out 10 young men. And David said unto the men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall you say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace be both to thee, and peace be to thine house, and peace be to all thou hast. And now I've heard that thou hast shearers, and now thy shepherds were with us, and we hurt them not, neither was there aught missing unto them. We didn't pilfer anything of yours all the time that they were in Carmel. Ask thy young men, they'll tell you. Wherefore, let the young men, the ones I'm sending to you, find favor in thine eyes, for we come in a good day. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh into thine hand, unto thy servants, and to thy son David. Or he's submitting himself to some extent to this fellow. And David's young men came, and they spake to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David, and ceased. Now, Nabal's name, and we're going to see this in a little bit. We have long passed this. You have to look up. Most of us, I think, know what our name means. But we weren't named because weren't named because it means something. It's because somebody, oh, I like the sound of that name. Or I know somebody who has that name. And we're named after somebody, or somebody just liked it. I know a few people that are named particularly because of what the name means. I have a good friend who pastors in Illinois, and he and his wife both married late. They were in their mid-30s when they got married, and wanted desperately to have children as soon as possible because, you know, the clock's ticking. And I think it was 3 or 4 years go by, and nothing. And she was a registered nurse, and she's beginning to worry, you know, and she wasn't looking good. And they prayed, and they prayed, and they prayed, and God gave them a son. And his name, of course, is Samuel, which means asked of God. And that's why they named him that. But Nabal means, don't name your child Nabal, because it means fool. I suppose his parents were of the sort that named their other son Sue, you know. I don't know if this was the name that he was given at birth, or because of his demeanor, this is the name that, that got latched onto him. It's sort of a nickname, I don't know, but his name means fool. Now, a fool is not, biblically, is not necessarily somebody who's stupid. Maybe somebody very intelligent, maybe talented, maybe very successful. But biblically, a fool is someone who does not have a right view of God. Go through the book of Proverbs. You see this over and over again. You see this to some extent in the Psalms as well. Isaiah 32, verse 6, for the vile person, word fool, will speak villainy, and his heart will work iniquity, to practice hypocrisy and to utter error against the Lord, to make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. He is a spiritual and moral and social disaster. And you look in verse 17, verse 21, and verse 25. This is not only the what is stated here by the writer of the book, but it is the opinion of David and of the man's servants and of his wife. In other words, this is the way the guy really is. It's a self-evident thing. It is not said to demean him. He is that. Again, the inspired writer here authorizes that by declaring it himself. So, sheep shearing time. It's a time of generosity, time to count the stock, and of course, shear the sheep. David has, to some extent, earned his request. Drop down to verse 15. This is Nabal's servants talking to Abigail. It says, but the men, talking about David's men, were very good unto us, and we were not hurt, neither missed we anything, as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They were a wall unto us, both by night and by day, all the while we were keeping the sheep out there on the range. Now, understand that it isn't just that they happened to be in the same place and David's men did not steal any sheep or didn't do any rustling or anything of that nature. It's more than that. When you get to that southern edge of Judah, and we're going to see this in the upcoming chapters, who else lived there? Who was there in that borderland area? This is where the Amalekites were. That's their native country. You also had Midianites. You had a few other people there. How did those folks make a living? They were marauders, okay? They pillaged, and therefore Nabal could normally anticipate a certain amount of loss due to this kind of thing. He's got his shepherds scattered all over the whole area because the pasture is so lean. But it would be expected, that, especially if he's got this much stock, it might be expected he could lose 100 or more animals in any given season to thieves. And here, he's had a bumper crop, if you will. He's had a phenomenal year as far as his livestock is concerned. Why? Because David and his men out there are acting as a buffer to protect the ranchers, the shepherds and so on, from being pilfered by the others. They are a wall, it says here, to those enemies that would come in. So Nabal has benefited from David. David is not just saying, hey, it's a great time, you're rich, give me something. It's more than that. David and his men have acted as protectors in a place that needed protection. This is not a protection racket kind of situation. He was actually acting as a protection for the shepherds there in Judah. Not just Nabal, of course, the others that would be in that area, but he and his men were defending the southern border of Judah just by their presence. And so when he goes and asks for something, and by the way, the Mosaic Law talks about generosity to those who are poor and those who are without. And so this is not something that think, boy, that's awful, you know, bold of David to make that request. No, that's probably par for the course when you look at the culture, the situation, and what David had done. So the men come and make this request, and here's Nabal's answer, verse 10. This is a guy who shoots from the hip. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Now here, David formerly was the number three guy in the kingdom. He has proven himself valiant. Granted, he came from fairly humble stock, not real far away in Bethlehem. But here he's insulting him, not only because he is on the run, but he's insulting him personally. And so he says, shall I take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? Who are you that I should give you anything? And so David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told all these things to David. Now, Caleb is obnoxious. Caleb is rude. He is insulting. But has he, other than a lack of generosity, has he broken the Mosaic law? Has he broken law? Has he done anything wrong other than just being abrasive and obnoxious and not being generous? No, not really. I mean, he's not the sort of guy I want as my next door neighbor. I'm probably not going to hang out with this guy, but just because of what he's like. But he hasn't done anything overtly wrong. Now, David and his men are in need. You know, granted, they are a powerful force. You got this 600-man army, but they don't have anything. They're on the run. They've got what they can carry with them. They don't accumulate belongings. They're in a survival mode. And so David gets this response. Now, when we have something like this tossed our way, we can have several responses. We just say, shrug our shoulders, you know. Or we can perhaps pity the likes of Nabal, saying, man, I pity this guy's family and the people that have to deal with him on a regular basis. Oh, my word, we'll have to look someplace else. But sometimes we get really angry over something like this. Did you hear what he said about me? After all I have done, after what I have done for this guy, this is how he treats me. And that's how David responded. The ducks are attacking. Because there's no discuss. What is the first thing that David says? Verse 13, David said unto his men, gird on every man his sword. Get ready to fight. And they girded every man his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and they went up after David about 400 men and 200 abode by the stuff. So they're going to leave 200 behind to guard the hideout. And 400 men are on their way up to Carmel to deal with Nabal. Now, understand that David's force is going to have no trouble wiping out everybody there in Carmel.
He's probably hungry too.
I mean, what he is going to do is he's not only going to avenge himself, but he is going to plunder that whole town. This is how they treated me? Fine. They don't deserve my goodwill. I need this stuff and I'm going to go get it. They deserve whatever they got coming. What did they do to him? One guy, granted powerful, influential guy, probably the most powerful man in the area, insulted David, and it really ticked David off. I mean, he is just fit to be tied. And because David can, he doesn't have to worry. David can do what he pleases. If Saul can't catch him, who is going to stop him from wiping out Carmel? Nobody. He does that. He runs back into the wilderness. It's as if nothing happened as far as David is concerned. So he doesn't have to worry about the authorities coming after him because they're already after him. He's got nothing to lose as far as temporal. So David gets ready to avenge himself. He loses his temper. Rage over reason. And he doesn't consider the repercussions. Now remember, David at this stage is probably about 27 years old. He has been anointed king. And he's about to go and wipe out one of the towns that theoretically he will eventually be king over. This does not bode well politically. This is not a wise move. He's going to lose his reputation. He's going to hurt his testimony as far as being a godly man. It is a sin for David to do so. To react to somebody else's unkindness and so on. We need to guard our testimonies. I am wired more like David is responding. You did what to me? I want to react. But it's wrong for me to react. And sometimes I do react. By the grace of God, I can think of a couple of times where somebody did something. When I was working at the print job, we had one lady there that was just Mabel in a skirt. Okay? And and everybody there knew it. And she did something to me just because she's that way. And I stopped. She dumped something on my head. A bunch of, I worked at a printing company. We had a die cut that, you know, when you have the pegboard and it's got those little things and they hang them up there, it's got a little hole in the thing. We had hundreds of thousands of these little tiny cardboard circles. And all the dust and crud that goes with those when they're being punched out. And she took a handful. I've been over to pick up some. She took a handful. These just dumped up on my head. And I'm just trying to get them out of my hair along with all the crud that's in there. And I'm sorry I offended you. Oh, that's what I said to her. I said, I'm sorry I offended you. That's the grace of God. That is not my gut reaction. And so even though you're dealing with a rude, obnoxious person, David, if he follows through, is going to suffer the consequences of murder. Because that's what he'd be doing. J.R. McDuff, who wrote this in 1881, he was a popular author back in that era, said, "Oh, how jealous we should be of anything that would reduce us so low as this and give a handle to the adversary. Beware of religious inconsistency. One fatal step, one unguarded word may undo a lifetime of hallowed influence. One scar on the character, one blot on the page of the living epistle is indelible. It may be washed away indeed by the blood of sprinkling, so that nothing of it will remain in the book of God. But the eye and memory of the world, keen to watch and treasure the inconsistencies of God's people, will not so easily forgive or forget." The world is watching. And they may do as they please. They may run amok and be involved in all kinds of wickedness and debauchery. But let a Christian step out of line. Look what he did. Did you see that? Did you see that? How dare he point out our wickedness and debauchery and adultery and murder and all that other stuff? Did you see what he did? He cheated. So we need to be very careful. But David is having that gut reaction. And he's on his way to take vengeance into his own hands. Now, in the meantime, while David is on his way from his hideout up to Carmel to take things into his own hands, Nabal's servants, who had been there watching Nabal's reaction to David, what are they going to do? Because they know we got a problem here. Do they go to reason with the fool.
No.
You can't reason with a fool. They go talk to the wife. These guys have been around the block a few times. They know who to go to. All of us have this. You know, if the kids know this in the house, they know who to come to first. Dad is only second recourse. Now, it depends on what they want. Sometimes they'll come to me first because they know I'm a soft touch in certain areas. So they have this down to a fine-tuned science, who to approach. And so these guys know there's no point in going to Nabal. Nabal's the one that already dug the hole that we're in. So let's go to Abigail because she's the I won't necessarily say the brains of the outfit because Nabal's no fool when it comes to business and stuff. He's a smart, talented guy. He's just obnoxious and rude. So Abigail intervenes. She does what her husband should have done in the first place. And it says in verse 18, Abigail made haste. She's in a hurry. Time is of the essence. We have to deal with this. We can't wait. She took 200 loaves. Don't think of, you know, big stuff. Think of something like this. Like a great huge roll. And 2 bottles of wine. That'd be 2 skins of wine. Don't think of something like this. Think of, you know, a goat skin. 5 sheep ready dressed. Probably hot off the rotisserie. 5 measures of parched corn, so about 5 bushels. 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs. We're talking about, you know, little things like this. So that's a fair amount of food, and she loaded them on the donkeys. Or had them loaded on the donkeys. That sounds like an awful lot. That's something you could load up on probably 4 or 5 donkeys. It's not a huge amount of stuff. It's not a huge amount of stuff. A dressed sheep, and you're not going to be dealing with the old, really chewy, jerky-like sheep. You're going to be dealing with yearlings and stuff like that. So you're not talking about a super huge animal, especially back in those days. So this is something that could be loaded on probably 5-6 donkeys. It is, how many men has David got? 600. Nabal's got how much livestock? Who knows how much food he has produced for the shearing of that kind of, that number of animals. This is a pittance. But it's enough. It's enough. And she said unto her servants, verse 19, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she didn't tell her husband. Why? He'd have told her not to do it. And it was so that as she rode on the ass, she came down by the covert of the hill, round the corner of the ravine there, and behold, David and his men came down against her. Come around the corner, there's David. She probably only a couple miles from town. Not real far away. Now David had surely said, surely in vain have I kept all this fellow hath in the wilderness, and he's requited me evil for good. He says, I'm going to kill everybody, all the men, all the males, even the children. Verse 22. I'm going to kill them all. Verse 23. And when Abigail saw David, she hasted, lighted off the donkey, fell before David on her face and bowed herself to the ground. And fell at his feet and said, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be. Let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience and hear the words of thine handmaid. So let me speak first. Got to tell you what's going on here. Let's pause for a minute. Speak a little reason here. Let not my Lord, I pray thee, regard this fellow, this man of Belial, even Nabal. So she's honest assessment of her husband. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him. But I, thine handmaid, saw not the young man. I wasn't there. I didn't know what had happened until after the fact. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, seeing the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood and from avenging thy son. See, she is so slick. She is flattering and yet rebuking at the same time. You know, she's honoring David and saying nice things about him, but he says, the Lord has kept you from coming and avenging yourself by my being here in time. You know, the book of Proverbs, a soft tongue turneth away wrath. So we need to respond instead of react. Which is not always easy. Like I said, we like to react. And sometimes we do without having... It's almost like when you touch something hot and you pull away and then you go, ooh, ouch. Because the signal bypassed your thinking process. And sometimes we react because it seems to bypass our thinking processes. We just do. And then we think, what did I do that for? And so we need to make sure that we retract ourselves more into an Abigail mode as opposed to a David and Nabal mode. Because understand that David, in what he's doing up to this point, he's right here. He's no better than this guy. He is no better than this guy. Looking at David's character in the past, and yet right now, this is where he is. The best of the best can be here. Just takes the right set of circumstances. There is no sin that could not be committed by any of us here under the right provocation if we are not yielded to the Lord. And the devil's looking for those opportunities to provoke. So, she goes through the speech and says that Nabal is indeed a fool. And she pacifies David's anger. Does she bring a whole lot of stuff? No, we just went through the list. It was a fair bit of stuff. I mean, it's a big picnic, you know. But not for 600 people. This is just a token. This is just a little bit. It's not going to hurt Nabal's wealth. But it does the job as far as... And what Nabal should have done in the first place.
She was in a hurry.
She was in a hurry, but at the same time, it was enough. And David only sent 10 men. How much could they carry out of the 600? David wasn't looking for looting. He was looking for basically what he got here. So, David's anger is pacified. And he thanks her. He says in verse 33, blessed be thy advice, and blessed be thou, for thou hast kept me this day from coming to shed blood and avenging myself with mine own hand. You have kept me from doing something I shouldn't have done. And then he says what he would have done. So he says, go up in peace. I have heeded your voice. And so they part ways and go back the way they came. Verse 36, Abigail gets home. She has done what she did. You can imagine she's like this. That's taken care of. You can imagine this poor woman is probably having to go around constantly fixing all the things that Nabal does. I don't know if you know or not, Henry Ford, the old man, the guy who started the company, was like Nabal in his temperament. He was an obnoxious, smart guy, but just run roughshod over everybody. He's going to get what he needs, and he's just, Edsel, his son, the guy the car's named after, died, I think, before his father, because Edsel was having to go and constantly put out all the fires that his father started, and it wore him out and killed him. That's Abigail. She is having to deal with all this stuff that her husband's doing. She's the PR agent for her husband. So she gets home. It's over. And her husband's drunk because he's still partying. So she doesn't tell him anything. He's drunk. Verse 37. Next morning, when the wine was gone out of Nabal, she told him everything. It says his heart died within him and he became as stone. The older book said he had an apoplectic fit. He just If you look up apoplexy, you'll find that it's a generic term. And you look up all these different people who lived 100 years ago or more died of apoplexy. What is that? They had a heart attack, or they had a stroke, or something where they went unconscious and then died shortly thereafter. They didn't know what it was. Could be any number of things. But that's what happened to this guy. And 10 days later, he died. And David hears about this, and he thinks, you know, that lady over there who's now a widow, that's the kind of wife I want. And he goes and gets Abigail as his wife. So, cooler heads, right over rage, and Nabal still doesn't have any reason when it's all said and done. Now, God rescued David from wickedness. Sometimes he does that for us. Sometimes he lets us have our own way to teach us. But, man, the pieces we got to pick up afterward. So, let's not step into the mode. Even as good a man as David was right here for a little while until somebody came in. And be willing to accept rebuke when it comes from somebody that you're not used to getting it from, because sometimes we'll react this way to the person who's trying to help us along the way as well. All right, we're over time. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for the lessons that we can learn. Father, we have never arrived. We will not arrive until glory. And even as good a man as David could be set off by this duck of a man, Nabal. And Father, help us to be aware that we have to deal with the enemy. And the enemy is going to use whatever means that are available at his disposal. And sometimes it's some obnoxious person that comes along and sets us off. And Father, may we respond and not react. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.